This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, you know now that every month is something when it comes to your health. And it just so happens that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and with good reason.
Sure.
You know, there's only one cancer that kills more people than cancer of the colon, and that is lung cancer, interestingly enough. And if you don't smoke, cancer of the colon is the one that you're more likely to die of, most likely to die of. And one in 17 Americans at some point in their lives are going to be diagnosed with cancer of the colon. So I guess the question is, if it's that common, why don't we hear more about it?
I'll tell you why.
Why?
Ew.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
that's the reason.
That's probably reason number one. People just don't like to talk about diseases of the colon. It's just not a pleasant subject.
No.
And it's not the topic of conversation at most cocktail parties.
No, not a good one.
And the other interesting thing about cancer of the colon is that it is not sex specific. You know, women talk about and are worried about breast cancer. Men worried about prostate cancer. They don't talk a lot about it, but that's what men worry about. And colon cancer, therefore, gets left out.
Well, not today. Our guest is colon cancer expert, Dr. Paul Lindberg. He'll tell us who's at risk for getting cancer of the colon and rectum and tell us when and how often we should be screened. We'll talk about what the options are for doing that, because those are changing and improving, hopefully, and tell us about some of the things we can do to prevent cancer of the colon and rectum. But first...
Exactly. You know, interesting story this week, and I bet you know someone, and we all know someone, who has had a joint replacement, even some of your friends who are relatively young.
Maybe.
The two most common joint replacements, replacement of the hip and the knee. Did you ever wonder how many people in the United States have had a new hip or a new knee? Well, we now know.
Oh.
And that's thanks to Dr. Daniel J. Berry, who is chairman of orthopedic surgery at the Mayo Clinic. And he joins us live from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons annual meeting in New Orleans. He's a former president of that organization. Dr. Berry, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Dr. Shives.
So how many people in the United States are walking around with a new hip or a new knee?
Well, the number's remarkable. There are about 2.5 million people walking around with a new hip replacement, around 4.5 million or a little more than that walking around with a knee replacement. So all told, about 7 million Americans have had either their hip or knee replaced.
Pretty incredible,
Sheesh,
isn't it?
I guess.
How many of these surgeries are being done every year?
Between hip and knee replacement together, about 1 million are done every year.
Wow. And why the boom?
Well, I think it's probably attributable to several things. Number one, the demographics of our country are changing. As the baby boom population ages, there are more people with arthritis. Secondly, people are aware of the fact that hip and knee replacements is a successful operation that oftentimes can get them back on their feet. And people nowadays are just not willing to remain inactive. They like to be independent and as active as possible.
Are younger people getting hip replacement or knee replacement?
Yes, it's fair to say that the age range in which we're willing to consider doing hip and knee replacement has dropped down as the technology has gotten better and the implants have become more durable.
So the indications have been increased. There are more people who are candidates now than there used to be.
I think it's fair to say that.
In general, though, who is a candidate for this type of surgery?
In general, it's somebody who has substantial pain from either their hip or knee joint. Most people that have substantial pain would also have substantial functional limitations, usually less ability to walk a distance or do the day-to-day activities they need to do, like get up and down stairs and so forth. And then a last and important part of the equation is that they need to have x-rays that show they have a very, very damaged joint. Because if the joint's not badly damaged, of course, the hip or knee replacement won't necessarily be helpful.
And so this is an operation that's done for pain, correct?
It's done mainly for pain, and usually there is also a functional benefit.
And these operations, total hips, total knees, have one of the highest success rates of any surgery that we do, right?
You're absolutely right. We can tell patients that the likelihood that the joint replacement will help them if they're a carefully chosen patient is about 95%.
And just like any operation that's done, there are some potential complications. And what are those? What are the most common ones?
Well, I think that probably it depends on the specifics. The hip and knee replacements don't have the exactly the same profile of complications, but the main categories of complications would be problems such as infection or problems with medical problems around the time of surgery or very specific problems related to the joint replacement that can be mechanical things. In the long term, the big concerns of the implants can wear out and loosen up.
It seems like younger people that I know, when I say that I'm thinking of 50-somethings or 60-somethings, are getting their knees done before they would get their hips done. And then they usually have to get both knees done. Is that common, that both knees have to be replaced?
If someone has arthritis of one knee, it's very common that the other knee also will have arthritis.
You know, Dr. Barry, we're all aware of the ads that we see on TV, the attorneys saying, you know, if you've had this hip or that hip, and even if you're not having any trouble with it, you might be eligible for some compensation. Why are we hearing so much about recalls and presumed joint failures?
Well, it's an excellent question. I think it has to do with one of the things that you've already brought up, and that is that more and more younger and active patients want these technologies. And as younger, more active patients need these technologies, the people that design them and the manufacturers that make them have really made an effort to use innovative technology to try to make the implants last longer. But you'll recognize, of course, that innovative technology can be a double-edged sword. Sometimes it leads to big steps forward, but other times there can be unexpected problems. And nowadays, if there's an unexpected problem, it tends to play out in a much more public way than it did in the past.
When a patient asks you before their surgical procedure, how long is this going to last? What do you normally tell them?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer because you can never tell an individual patient how long the joint replacement will last. But what I tell them is that the chances of a joint replacement lasting the average patient 20 years is about 80%. So that's a pretty good likelihood of success.
Wow. Dr. Dan Barry, thanks so much for joining us from New Orleans. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shives.
Yep, good to talk to you. Time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with colon cancer expert Dr. Paul Limburg, plus myth or matter of fact. You know, I had to change that one because we talked about the fact that this is a disease that affects both men and women.
I was
so
making
let's do
it
this
too
one.
Easy.
If I have colon surgery, I'll need a colostomy bag. Myth or matter of fact?
We'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for Dr. Limburg at 507-282-1234. You can contact us at our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or the tweets are already starting, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Dr. Tom and Tracy, along with this week's guest, Dr. Paul Limburg, colon cancer expert and gastroenterologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Dr. Limburg, great to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom and Tracy. Nice to be here.
This is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, March 2014.
And presidential proclamation.
Exactly.
We've got it here.
That means it must be important.
Yeah.
And it is an important disease, isn't it, Dr. Limburg?
It is. As you mentioned in the intro, it's the second leading cause of cancer death among all Americans.
90% preventable?
90% at least preventable. That's what the data would show now.
So tell us how you do that.
Well, the benchmark or foundation of colon cancer prevention is screening. So there are multiple screening tests. I'm sure people have heard about things like stool tests or fecal occult blood tests, things like that. Again, not very pleasant to talk about, but highly effective.
Now, fecal occult blood test means you take a little sample of the stool and you check it for blood.
That's right.
Okay.
And that can be done in the home and mailed in, and then it's analyzed in the lab, and the doctor would tell you the result and whether or not there's any follow-up that needs to occur.
Is that a good alternative to a colonoscopy?
I think there's a lot of debate about that, but really the short summary is the best test is the one that gets done. So not every test is the right one for any individual. If you're in a rural area and you don't have access to a place where you can get a colonoscopy easily, things like that, there are reasons why fecal occult blood tests or some of the newer stool tests may work better for you.
And how many years have we been able to do that blood test, the fecal occult blood test?
The fecal occult blood test has been around for over 100 years. Now, it hasn't been used for colon cancer screening for that long, mm-hmm. but it's to detect blood in the stool. And that can be because of hemorrhoids, that can be because of other colon problems, that can be because of colon polyps or cancers.
So the gold standard is still the colonoscopy. And when should you get that and how often thereafter?
Yeah, the gold standard is colonoscopy in many people's opinion because when you do the screening exam, you can also take care of any precancerous polyps. Colonoscopy is the only of one of the screening tests that allow you to do that during the same exam. If you have a positive stool test, for example, you'd need to have a colonoscopy to do a follow-up diagnostic test. So colonoscopy or any colon cancer screening test should be done starting at age 50 in the absence of any colon cancer risk factors.
Which are?
So there's quite a few of them. The biggest two would be previous history of polyps. So if you've already had polyps detected for whatever reason, you need to be on a more frequent surveillance program, not a screening program. And if you have a strong family history of colon cancer, colon polyps, even some other types of cancers, then you would want to start screening at a younger age.
But if the numbers that Dr. Shives gave as we started were 1 in 17, is that number right, do you think? 1
yep.
in 17 people will be diagnosed? Then doesn't everybody have a family history almost at that point with those numbers?
That's a great question, Tracy. So I think a lot of people would. It wouldn't be everybody, and it probably isn't even the majority who has a close relative with colon okay. cancer or colon polyps. We look at first-degree relatives. So that would be parents, brothers and sisters, even children sometimes. So if there's a first-degree relative, particularly at a younger age, you would want to start screening earlier. If it's second-degree relatives, if you have multiple second-degree relatives, we would probably recommend screening at a younger age. When you get out to third-degree relatives, then you're probably just like the average risk population.
So let's face it. The big drawback to the screening test colonoscopy is it's unpleasant, particularly the prep to have the colonoscopy. It's expensive. It's a little bit time consuming. So let's talk about a couple of alternatives, a virtual colonoscopy and the new stool DNA test. What's your opinion on those?
So virtual colonoscopy is a wonderful tool. It was investigated here at Mayo Clinic and at some other centers. It's an X-ray test. The downside is you still have to take the prep to get cleaned out, again, in most cases, to get cleaned out before the radiologist can see adequately.
But isn't that the big problem?
It is.
Is the prep.
It is for most people. That's the number one complaint. I don't want to do that prep.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at virtual colonoscopy, if there are no polyps, you wouldn't need to be screened any more often than every 5 years. Colonoscopy, if you have no polyps, you may not need to be screened any more often than once every 10 years. So it's worth the effort.
Yeah, and you know, the test itself isn't bad. It's the prep. So
well,
as long as you've
gone
through the prep, you might as well
right.
have the snake.
And
that's
this
right.
is what I've heard from everybody, is that it's not that the test isn't the problem, it's the prep. And so if you're like me, and you're not old enough, Tom, to have
you
been
will
there
be.
Yet. I
just
know,
wait.
I will. I'm just teasing you. Well, I've taken lots of prep for other things, too. What is the prep? What does that mean for people who've never gone through it?
Yeah, so the prep, there's a few different varieties. The one that's used most commonly is something called polyethylene glycol or some derivative of that. It's a salty, sort of thick-tasting liquid that is much better if it's chilled, and you drink it either part of it the night before, part of it the morning of, sometimes now the entire prep the day of the procedure, depending on when the timing of the exam is. It cleans you out. So what goes in comes out, and everything else that's in there comes out too. So just be prepared for that. Again, it's not painful. It's just multiple trips to the bathroom.
And the advantage of the colonoscopy is if you find a polyp, you can remove it while you're there.
That's right. So,
and most cancers of the colon, develop in a polyp?
And that's that 90% number. So if you can do the screening test, find the polyps, remove them, you can prevent 90% at least of colon cancer.
But people are afraid of polyps. So I have so many friends that have gone through this and then, oh, they find a polyp. And then that just is, you know, shoots fear right into your heart. How often is a polyp cancerous?
Great question. So polyps typically would be precancerous. If a polyp is cancerous, that just means you've found the cancer at a very early curable stage more often than not. So the polyps are the target. We want to find the polyps before they turn into cancers so that they never become cancer. So the screening target is actually the polyp.
Yeah, they shouldn't be fearful. They should say, I'm one lucky cowgirl.
Glad
they
that we found them.
They got that polyp out.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly.
All right, a little bit more about the test that your colleague, Dr. David Ahlquist, is working on. It's called a DNA stool test. And if I understand it correctly, you take a stool specimen and you check it for DNA. Not for blood, but for DNA, which would tell you whether or not there's cancer in the colon.
Yeah, so apologies to those who are enjoying their breakfast. We'll talk more about stool. But the stool
test... I think
test,
it's too late.
Yeah. The stool DNA test is actually the newest test that's being evaluated by investigators and the FDA is something called Cologuard. And it's actually multi-marker. So it's a multi-marker panel. It's got DNA targets. It's got what are called epigenetic or methylated gene targets. They've investigated blood as a component of that panel. So it really gives sort of a comprehensive profile of things, abnormalities that could be detected from either a polyp or a cancer.
Is it going to, do you think, obviate the need for a colonoscopy or other tests?
Potentially, it will obviate the need for a screening colonoscopy. So again, terminology. Screening is the first test that you would do. So if you had the stool DNA test and it was normal, then you wouldn't need to have a screening colonoscopy or any other colonoscopy at that point. If you had a screening DNA, stool DNA test, and there was an abnormality, you may need a diagnostic colonoscopy to follow up. So it's a first step, a different first step, maybe a better first step than having to do colonoscopy in the numbers of patients that receive that test now for screening.
If we're talking about genetics, what about, well, the conversation about genetics then? If a person... you know, in the very near future, well, even now actually, can go in and get a genetic workup done. Is there a marker for colon cancer?
There are. Clinical history, family history is a very good indicator for some of the major syndromes that we would think about for colon cancer, high-risk genetic syndromes. One called hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer syndrome, long name, more commonly Lynch syndrome. If there are cancers in the family younger than age 50, cancers in the colon, cancers in female organs, cancers in other body parts in three or more members, that's an indicator of possible Lynch syndrome. Familial adenomatous polyposis, or FAP, is another relatively common syndrome for colon cancer. That's a condition where hundreds to thousands of polyps develop throughout the intestinal tract. So oftentimes people, patients know that about their family members.
Sure.
And when you bring that information to your doctor, you know, it's pretty straightforward what the follow-up would be.
So you wouldn't have to have a genetic workup done to determine that. You could actually use what your family's histories are instead of a genetic workup.
That's right. So then you could stratify the risk within the family. So once you've identified a family that may be, or a patient in a family that may be at risk for those syndromes, you could use the genetic test to screen the individuals within the family to say yes or no.
So what are some of those other ones? You said female cancers, like uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, or bladder cancer, any of those types?
To a much lesser degree. Endometrial cancer, renal cancer.
Endometrium, that's uterus.
Uterus, yep.
Okay.
Kidney cancer of a specific subtype. Those are things that go along with Lynch syndrome.
Interesting.
All right, the DNA test, again, how accurate is it? What have the studies shown? And when might it be available? Because it's not there. We don't have it yet, correct?
Yep, we don't have it yet. The first generation of the stool DNA test was available for a short period of time. It didn't work quite as well as people wanted it to. The newer generation, the more comprehensive panel, is showing fairly remarkable sensitivity, specificity, ability to find polyps, ability to find patients who don't have polyps or cancers in a screening setting. So, you know, upwards of 80 to 90%, depending on the exact scenario. So it's a very accurate test, and the FDA is reviewing it now, is my understanding. I'm not directly involved with that at this point, but we hope later this year that test will be available for patients to use.
And of course, the drawback to that test is the same as the occult blood test, and that is you have to send in a stool specimen.
That's right.
Other than that, we hope that it's an answer to the problem of how best to screen and how to easily screen for colon cancer.
Yep, and there are a couple other advantages. Another big one is if people have had a stool blood test before, fecal occult blood test, your doctor may have told you need to be on a specific diet, you need to stay off of these types of medications before you collect your sample. That's not true with the stool DNA test. It's a little bit simpler.
All right, we want to catch this early, and we want to catch up when it's in the precancerous or polyp stage. But let's say someone hasn't been screened. They may or may not have a family history of colon cancer. If they're going to develop symptoms related to cancer of the colon, what might those be?
So It's important to emphasize that polyps typically don't have any symptoms. So you need to be screened even if you have no symptoms. Symptoms that you should pay attention to and bring to the attention of your doctor for further evaluation would be, unexplained abdominal pain, unintentional weight loss, bleeding with bowel movements or bleeding on the toilet tissue. They may not imply colon cancer or colon polyps, but they need to be evaluated.
All right. Before we go to our break, one more myth or matter of fact. If I have colon surgery, I'll need a colostomy bag. Myth or matter of fact?
Myth for the most part. So the majority of instances for colon cancer surgery, even rectal cancer surgery, rectum is the lower part of the intestinal tract, can be done without a colostomy bag or ostomy bag. There are, based on anatomic location, so very low rectal cancers would still require a colostomy, at least at this point in time. The analogy would be the surgeons need enough tissue to knit the intestine back together or to stitch the colon back together after the tumor's removed.
But that's an even bigger reason why you need to go and get screened to find those polyps so that you don't get to that stage.
That's right.
And this is, as long as it's localized, this is a surgical disease, right? If you can cut it out, you can potentially cure the patient.
Yep. Surgery is the cornerstone of treatment for colon cancer. There are some other things. Radiation treatment can be effective for rectal cancers. Chemotherapy can be effective for colon and rectal cancers.
The other significant advance is that a significant percentage of these colon cancers can be removed laparoscopically, right through the telescope, and you don't have to have a big incision in the abdomen to remove it.
Great point. Another major advance over the last decade or so, and much of those surgical enhancements have been pioneered here at Mayo Clinic.
All right. So we know that screening is important beginning at age 50 if you don't have a family history, earlier if you do. And the two biggest risk factors, a history of polyps or a family history of colon cancer. Dr. Paul Lindbergh. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest and expert on colon cancer, Dr. Paul Lindbergh of the Mayo Clinic.
Coming up after this week's health and medical news with Vivian Williams, and then we'll take your phone calls, and I have so many tweets to get to. Our phone number is 507-282-1234. Our blog is radio.mayoclinic.org, and the tweets, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Knee replacements. For many people with rheumatoid arthritis, knee replacements can help relieve pain and restore function. But should you have both knees done at the same time? Researchers from the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York found same-day bilateral knee replacement surgery is safe for certain patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Now, the researchers say people with rheumatoid arthritis are more likely to have other medical conditions than are people with wear and tear or osteoarthritis, and this can bring about complications during surgery. So that's why many have their knees done in separate operations. But this research shows getting both knees replaced at the same time is safe for the right patient. And now, having a big belly has consequences beyond trouble squeezing into your pants. It's bad for your health, even if you have a healthy body mass index, or BMI. A Mayo Clinic study found that men and women with large waist circumferences were more likely to die younger and were more likely to die from illnesses such as heart disease, respiratory problems, and cancer. Here's Mayo Clinic Dr. James Serhan.
What's a little newer here, maybe a little less recognized, is that even a greater waist circumference in the normal body mass index range, where people would say, oh, well, you're normal, you don't have to worry, we actually saw elevated risks occurring there. So this applies across the BMI spectrum, not just at the high ends. If you already have low BMI or low waist circumference, then the goal would be to maintain that over your life course. If you have a high BMI, and particularly a high waist circumference, then the first issue should be, well, we don't want it to get larger because there's incremental health risks. And even if you can make a small decrease, there's actually strong health benefits for that. So you don't necessarily have to go back to the very low levels, but even losing some belly fat, and that's usually through changes in diet and physical activity, will have important health benefits.
And this was published in the journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings. And now, when you have sore muscles, a fever, a headache, what do you reach for? Many of us grab a commonly used pain reliever. Well, a new study shows common pain relievers known as NSAIDs are also thought to be able to kill bacteria. Researchers say this discovery could open new strategies for fighting drug-resistant infections and so-called superbugs. Now, they didn't test the NSAIDs in aspirin, ibuprofen, and naproxen to get over the counter, but the NSAIDs they did test resulted in good news in the fight against potentially dangerous bugs. And this study was published in the journal Chemistry and Biology. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Information You Want from Specialists Who Know. Dr. Tom Shives, Tracy McRae, and we are on air. We're online, and we're on iHeartRadio. And if you want to listen live, go to KROCAM.com.
We've got tweets, we've got questions, and Bill is on the line with our first question of the day, 507-282-1234. Good morning, Bill. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Say, doctor, by this two-part question, I had the colonoscopy, whatever, but, you know, I laid on my side, they gave me a Valium drip, and it's not that big a deal, you know? I mean, people make it into a bigger thing than it really is. And my doctor prescribed me just with a small little vial of the stuff I drank. Everybody else that I talked to down there, but what I worked with, that had them, had to drink that whole quart or whatever. And it's a difference in doctors what they prefer, you know.
Yeah, and Bill, that is such a good point, and it's come up before. And so tell us about it. How come some people get the little vial of stuff, and the others have to drink the whole 14 gallons or whatever it is.
Feels like 14 gallons.
Yeah. So it's only 2 liters. It's not 14 gallons.
It
but,
just feels like it.
One size doesn't fit all, Bill. So I appreciate the point. There are multiple preps. You may have gotten something called mag citrate if it was in a little green bottle.
Yeah.
Works very, very well. The downside is that it's got some electrolytes in it, and it could, in a very small percentage of people, cause problems with the kidneys over time. So the preps that I mentioned, the polyethylene glycol preps, really have no side effects, if you can believe that. So the other preps have very small risks for potential complications. That's why we would choose the PEG solutions.
My other question, doctor, is my primary doctor down there at Mayo told me that maybe this is truth or a matter of fact, I don't know.
Good, we like those.
But he told me that polyps grow so slowly that I would be, I'm 63 right now, and I had mine at 50. But, I mean, he says it grows so slowly that I'd be, really wouldn't be that much at risk. I mean, because they do grow rather slowly. Now, is that truth or matter of fact?
I would call that truth. Polyps do grow really slowly. That's why if you've had a negative colonoscopy, typically we would say come back in 10 years. That should be enough time to find any precancerous polyps that have grown up over that time interval before they would even turn into a cancer. Now, having one colonoscopy and never coming back is probably not the best that we can do. So talk with your doctor and just, you know, understand what the trade-offs are and when you may want to return for another exam.
He was correct at that then, right, doctor?
That polyps grow slowly, yes, and that the interval can be up to 10 years between exams.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Hey, Bill, you're our new myth or matter of fact guy. Hey, Bill, hang on the line. We have a book for you, the Mayo Clinic book on gastrointestinal disorders. Do I have the name right? Do you remember what it is? Yeah, it's a great book. Bill, you hang on. Audrey will take your name and address, and we'll send you the book.
All right. Thanks so much, Bill. Now, we did have the myth or matter of fact that we had posted over the week about colorectal cancer being a man's disease, which we've addressed already. But do more men get colorectal cancer than women? We know both can get it, but which is the truth in there?
Yeah, so the numbers historically, Tracy, it would be more men than women over populations. As demographics shift, as women tend to outlive men, then, you know, there are more women around who can develop colon cancer at a later age. So on par, it's slightly more common in men, but not dramatically.
And what about ethnic populations? Is there differences there?
That's also a great question. So African American populations tend to have colon cancers at a higher rate and at a younger age.
I knew that from the presidential proclamation that I just read.
Excellent.
He had that in his proclamation. We have a couple of other questions. Do beer and wine show positive effects for colon cancer as it does for health, or is it just age?
It does for heart.
Yes, for heart, rather. Yes. So let's talk about that part of the tweet first.
Jury's still out. So there's arguments on both sides. Beer in particular, heavy beer drinkers have been thought to have increased risk for colon or even more rectal cancer. Wine maybe is protective, but it may be components within wine, something called resveratrol or other things within wine. So right now, there's not a positive or negative statement for beer or wine with respect to colon cancer.
Okay.
That big word you used, resveratrol, is that only in red wine?
Or is it's present in higher amounts in red wine. There are actually some white grapes that are resveratrol enriched now. So it's evolving healthy wine, if you can believe it.
The other part of that tweet had to do if it's wine and beer, or what about is it just food? And we had a posting on Facebook that referred to that from Taylor. What about the correlation between dairy consumption and colorectal cancer? So let's talk about food for a minute.
Yeah. So just a quick background comment. We talked about screening as being the most important thing you can do to prevent colon cancer. Modifiable risk factors are equally important, or maybe, you know, could contribute equally to prevention. So diet is a big factor. Western diet has been linked to increased risk for colon cancer. What's that mean? Lots of fatty foods, lots of processed grains, those sorts of things are not really good for your overall health, mm-hmm. and they're not good for your colon health. So healthy foods would be high fiber foods, natural products, fruits and vegetables, those sorts of things all seem to protect against colon polyps, colon cancers. Smoking is a colon cancer risk factor. Don't smoke. There's lots of health benefits to not smoking.
All right, 507-282-1234, our guest and expert on colon cancer. So from a prevention standpoint, diet, include a high fiber diet, is important. Smoking is bad. It's a risk factor for colon cancer. Alcohol, the jury is out. Other things I want to ask you about are aspirin, other anti-inflammatory medications, and physical activity.
Yeah. So non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, aspirin is one drug in that category. Others are ibuprofen, things like that. So those medications have been, for the last 30 years, maybe even longer, been shown to have a protective effect in what are called epidemiological or observational studies. That's where populations are followed over time. They're asked survey questions, do you use aspirin? Do you use any of these other drugs? And then they're followed up for various events. Repeatedly, colon cancer events are lower in individuals who have used aspirin or these non-steroidal drugs for longer periods of time. The trade-off is those drugs can have side effects. Even aspirin is not 100% safe. You can get stomach ulcers, you can have bleeding, et cetera, et cetera. So right now, on balance, the evidence does not support taking aspirin or a non-steroidal just to prevent colon cancer. It's a different story for heart health. So it may benefit you for heart health, and if so, you may also be at reduced risk for polyps.
Physical activity?
Fantastic colon cancer prevention strategy. Again, health benefits at multiple levels also helps prevent colon cancer maybe by as much as 50%.
Physical activity, anti-inflammatory medications maybe, and diet.
And
the
diet.
Things you can do to prevent colon cancer.
Yep.
High-fiber diet.
I mentioned a couple of them. Back to the question about dairy components, calcium and vitamin D, which are often in dairy products or milk, have been shown in multiple studies to reduce your risk. Again, there's not a blanket statement out there that everybody would say, you know, take these things. Calcium has been linked to some other health conditions. So talk with your doctor about it. But those would be the two components of dairy products that seem to have the most promise.
507-282-1234. Good morning, this is Audrey. Good morning, Audrey. You have a question about BMI?
Yes, I was wondering if obesity or BMI is a risk factor?
And having a high BMI.
And the answer is yes. Again, we've looked at that in various population-based studies, and individuals with a higher BMI or who are a higher weight relative to their height are at increased risk for diabetes, for heart disease, also colon cancer.
Audrey, thank you so much for bringing that up. We forgot to put that on the list. I forgot to put that on my list.
507-282-1234. Kelly has our next question. Good morning, Kelly. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I have a question about ongoing constipation, if there is any link between that and colon cancer.
Yeah, great question, Kelly. So chronic constipation that's been present for, you know, years is not a risk factor for colon cancer, as best anyone can tell, and that's been studied extensively. If you have a new change in bowel habits or a family member or a friend does, you know, again, that could be an early symptom of changes in the colon, including polyps, cancers, et cetera. But that's a different scenario than chronic constipation. So chronic constipation, no. Change in bowel habits, bring it to your clinician's attention.
Hey, Kelly, you sound very young, and I'm not sure you're the one who has this problem, and it doesn't really matter. But I wanted to ask Dr. Lindberg, what are your tips? What kind of advice do you give to patients who have problems with constipation, short of some kind of medication?
Yeah, so making sure that you stay hydrated. So 5 to 8 8-ounce glasses of water or liquid per day is a good way to improve bowel habits. High fiber diet or increased fiber in the diet, whether that's through changes in the foods you eat or through a supplement, and activity. So, you know, activity helps to get things moving all throughout your body. So those are some simple things you could try.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
I have a myth or matter of fact question for you. Colon cleansing. Does it rid the body of toxins and help prevent cancer? Is that a myth or a fact?
I would call that a myth. Colon cleansing, again, things have been around for a long time. Colon cleansing has been touted as solving all sorts of ailments, and the evidence is just not there.
Okay, but what about microbiome? Got to have a healthy gut, the acidophilus that's in yogurt. I don't even know what I'm supposed to be doing, but everybody, that's one of the new buzzwords, is having a healthy gut, like your microbes are balanced. What am I even talking about? I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, so this is an area that's being actively pursued. So there are bacteria in the gut, and those bacteria do lots of things. They help to process the foods that we eat. They may have some effect on different disease states, even chronic disease states. Over the last 5 years, I would say, research on the microbiome or bacteria that are symbiotic with the body has just taken off. And so the data are just now starting to come out. I don't think that colon cleansing and the microbiome are directly linked right now in terms of ridding your body of toxins, but more to come in terms of how the microbiome influences health.
It's interesting that it's being studied.
Yes.
That you see advertisements for probiotics. What are those, and is there any reason to think about taking them?
Yeah, probiotics in some instances can help. So people who have conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, sometimes probiotics can help to calm down inflammation in select settings. Probiotics are really designed to alter the composition of the bacteria in the colon.
That, you know, colon cleansing. Sorry.
I was just going to say that's actually one of the tweets that we just got. Does IBS or diarrhea, do those have anything to do with colon cancer?
They don't. So inflammatory bowel disease is sometimes called IBD. That's different from IBS, which is irritable bowel syndrome. Irritable bowel syndrome and diarrhea, no link to colon cancer. Again, recent change in bowel habits should be evaluated.
You know, the colon cleansing is such an interesting topic because of some of the claims that are made for colon cleansing, like it'll improve your mental outlook. Now, what does that suggest? It'll decrease your risk of colon cancer. Then it'll get rid of toxins that can cause arthritis, asthma, and allergies. It can lead to quick weight loss. It can increase energy, and it can enhance your immune system. Any of those make any sense?
No. But wow, it would be great if they did.
Shane wants to know via tweet, is there a link between gluten and colorectal cancer?
That's an excellent question, Shane. There's a link between gluten sensitivity and some tumors in the intestinal tract. Now, it's more small bowel cancer, which is exceedingly rare, even in individuals who have gluten sensitivity. There's not a link that anybody has identified with colon cancer.
All right, 507-282-1234. Karen is on the line. Good morning, Karen. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I was wondering, you were talking about probiotics and for colon, like Crohn's
health,
disease.
Yeah.
Is there a certain type that you should take?
You know, that would be a question that a specialist could better answer than myself. I wouldn't know which ones to recommend and under what circumstances. I think if somebody has Crohn's disease, getting on a medical therapy that keeps you at a maintenance state is the best initial approach. Using probiotics as an adjunct to standard medical therapies would make sense to me.
When you say a specialist, you mean someone with a particular interest in inflammatory bowel disease.
That's right.
And aren't you arranging a program for someone to come in to talk about Crohn's disease, one of the inflammatory bowel diseases?
We are. We're going to talk about celiac disease coming up, but I'm thinking we should do something about this healthy gut probiotics, because that is a lot of excitement around that in the health world.
Definitely.
Dan has a tweet. What is better, the colonoscopy or the camera? And hold on. Thank you, Karen, for calling in.
Thank you.
So Dan's tweet, what's better, the colonoscopy or the camera that you swallow?
Right now, the colonoscopy gives us a more detailed look. The camera that you swallow, there's a single-headed pill cam and there's a double-headed pill cam. So they're big tablets. They're hard for patients to swallow. The pill cam kind of tumbles through the gut, and as the camera points in a specific direction, it sees what it can see. It may miss things that are behind folds. It may miss things that are submerged in fluid, etc. So when we do the colonoscopy, we can get a much more detailed assessment.
What if you flush the camera?
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah. You mean that you'll still have the pictures?
The pill cam. Yeah, the pill cam actually sends the pictures wirelessly to a device that you wear, and it's meant to be flushed.
It's a wonderful time to be alive, Tom. We did a couple of more tweets. Some common signs and symptoms for colon cancer as we wind up here. Can you go over some of that again?
Yeah, so the take-home message is that colon polyps are what we're after to prevent colon cancer. Colon polyps typically don't have any signs or symptoms, so you need to follow screening recommendations. Colon cancer, some signs or symptoms can be if you're anemic, if you all of a sudden have lost energy and your doctor says your blood counts are low, if you have blood in the stool, blood in the toilet tissue, blood in the water, if you have abdominal pain that is really just new and persistent and different from things that you've experienced before with activity, etc., unintentional weight loss, those would all be things that you should get evaluated. They may not be related to colon cancer, could be signs of other conditions as well and deserve attention.
You know, you told us that colon cancer is 90% percent preventable, and nobody wants to get colon cancer. So the important thing is to get screened, and it's important for our listeners to know that this is paid for by most insurance companies, and it is paid for by Medicare. And also that the American Cancer Society has a new campaign where they want to get 80% of people who are eligible screened. How are you going to do that?
Through efforts like this. So thank you for having this as one of the focuses of the radio program. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Spread the word, tweet it, do whatever we can to get that message out there. To our Rep. Michelle in Florida, please help us so that 1 in 17 is not the number of people who get diagnosed with colon cancer. Right now, screening about two-thirds of the population, 67% get screened. We need to bump that number up to 80%.
Dr. Paul Lindbergh, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll tell you about next week's program in just a second. But
well,
Tracy,
tell us
about that colon.
Yeah, we have listeners from all over the world, of course, but our listeners that are in the Rochester, the Southeast Minnesota area, on Tuesday at the Gonda building here on the Mayo campus, you'll have an opportunity to walk through a colon. There's a giant colon you can walk through and learn a little bit about. There'll be experts there to answer any questions, but I've never walked through a colon, so I have to make time to do that on Tuesday.
Yeah, I think you can touch the polyps.
I think you can.
All right, next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll tell you about the new Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program. Our guest is Dr. Donald Hensrud. You know, we've come to realize that lifestyle factors are more important than anything else when it comes to staying healthy. Lifestyle factors like smoking, obesity, diet, how much you exercise, those are the keys to staying healthy.
That's what you hear again and again and again on this program. But the answer, well, the question is, how come we can't seem to implement it?
That's the missing piece.
Right.
But Not anymore. That's all about to change. Next week, we'll tell you about the new Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program with Dr. Donald Hensrud to answer all those questions and get you on the right track to a healthy lifestyle.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed today, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program and previous episodes. And don't forget, 24 hours a day at iHeartRadio as well. You can visit us at mayoclinic.org, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to empower you to manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer and phone screener is Audrey Castletine. Our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, Dr. Paul Lindbergh, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCrae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.